Oh, hello, humans in podcast land. Welcome back. My guest today is Stephen Pressfield. I read The War of Art, one of Stephen's best-selling non-fiction works, at the beginning of this year, and it had a really profound impact on me. Then I followed it up with Turning Pro, which did exactly the same and just totally blew my world apart, two books in a row. I just needed to get him on, had to have a discussion with him. I absolutely adore the concept of Turning Pro. And today, within the space of an hour, I think you get a pretty strong overview of exactly why you need to leave the amateur life behind. Stephen's such a great guy. He's just filled with cool stories and really interesting off-the-wall examples of how Turning Pro has really changed people's lives. I hope that it has as strong of an impact on you as it did on me. And if you fancy checking out either of his books, they've got like thousands of reviews on Amazon, and you can get through both of them in probably 2 hours if you read at a normal speed. They're not very long. They're only 100 pages, a couple of hundred pages. So yeah, if you end up turning pro by the end of this episode, then let us know. I would love to find out if you resonate with any of the lines and the stories that Stephen brings out today, because I know that I certainly did. All right, quick maths. The less that your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have, the more money that you keep. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce the costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite, and you are improving efficiency by bringing all your business processes into one platform. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move, so do the maths and see how you will profit with NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/modern right now. That's netsuite.com/modern. This episode is brought to you by Crafted London. Finding men's jewelry that doesn't suck is very difficult, and Crafted London have nailed it. They are the number one men's jewelry company worldwide. They're sweatproof, waterproof, heatproof, and gymproof. They've got custom designs in gold and silver, necklaces, chains, pendants, bracelets, rings, and earrings. If you've seen me on any of the big cinema episodes on YouTube wearing a necklace, it will always be from Crafted. I absolutely love it. It works with formal wear, casual wear, whether it's daytime or nighttime. All of their pieces are super high quality. The designs are great, and I love them. It's all I wear. Also, they have an unlimited lifetime guarantee, so if your piece breaks for any reason at any point during the entire life of the product, they will give you a new one for free. Get a 15% discount site-wide on everything by going to bit.ly/cdwisdom and using the code MW15 at checkout. That's bit.ly/letter C letter D wisdom and MW15 at checkout. This episode is brought to you by Whoop. I have worn Whoop for over 4 years now, since way before they were a partner on the show, and it is the only wearable I have ever stuck with because it's the best. It is so innocuous, you do not remember that you've got it on, and yet it tracks absolutely everything 24/7 via something from your wrist. It tracks your heart rate, it tracks your sleep, your recovery, all of your workouts, your resting heart rate, your heart rate variability, how much you're breathing throughout the night. It puts all of this into an app and spits out very simple, easy to understand, and fantastically usable data. It's phenomenal. I am a massive, massive fan of Whoop, and that is why it's the only wearable that I've ever stuck with. You can join for free, pay nothing for the brand new Whoop 4.0 strap, plus you get your first month for free, and there's a 30-day money-back guarantee. So you can buy it for free, try it for free, and if you do not like it, after 29 days, they will give you your money back. Head to join.whoop.com/modernwisdom. That's join.whoop.com/modernwisdom. But for now, it's time to learn how to turn pro with Stephen Pressfield. So we'll have some people listening whose lives could be changed forever by turning pro. Can we make that happen within the next hour, do you think?
We'll give it our best shot here.
That would be a pleasure. So as a tiny bit of background, I read both The War of Art and Turning Pro this year, and they had a very profound impact on how I view the things that I do in my life. And I wanted to kind of gift the audience, hopefully, with the same insights that your book gave me. So first off, why did you write Turning Pro?
You know, it was just a follow-up to The War of Art, because I've, you know, in The War of Art, there is a section, as you know, called Turning Pro. It's the middle section. But I felt like I hadn't really said everything that I wanted to say, and that it needed, a little amplification. So, so I just kind of amplified it a little bit.
Let me ask you something,
before we even start. How does the concept of resistance in The War of Art, how does that affect what you do? Where did it impact your life?
So resistance, thankfully, in podcasting is not as much of a burden to bear. Reason being that you naturally are on this treadmill with the other person. You have this external accountability, right? So I can't just stop this conversation if resistance arises, because you're there. And you can't stop this conversation because I'm here, and I'm here to help you. I'll ask you a question. You'll help me. So resistance to me manifests much more when I'm writing newsletters, which, again, your experience is writing books, sitting down, blank page in front of you, and you struggle. But it's interesting for me to have that dichotomy, and there may be people listening as well for whom they have resistance that manifests very strongly in certain areas of their life and then doesn't in others. And I certainly think things that you can do with other people, team sports, you turn up to training for rugby and the resistance kind of doesn't really seem to be there. You turn up to do a solo session in the gym and you're just swimming in resistance, right? So that's something, that was an insight that I gained this year.
Okay, great.
So yeah, that was something that I saw. I absolutely adored the idea of Turning Pro. So how do we define an amateur? Let's start before we even get into professionals. How do we define an amateur?
One of the ways, I think, is an amateur as a rule is kind of a weekend warrior, and an amateur when they hit adversity are going to quit. That's probably the ultimate sign. And I lived for years as an amateur, and dropping the ball, fumbling the ball on the 1 yard line, to use an American football analogy, that kind of thing, being unable to finish something. Whenever adversity would strike, I would cave into it. An amateur, there are many other aspects of an amateur, but an amateur usually does a lot of talking about what they're going to do, whereas a professional usually just shuts up and does the work. I think a lot of the modern maladies that we all suffer from, anxiety, depression, isolation, et cetera, that we blame ourselves for, right? We put a judgment on ourselves. We say that, either we're weak or we're, there's something wrong with us, or we're sick, or we're sick or something like that. We have some neurotic, issue, whatever it is. I think a lot of those problems are really just about the difference between being an amateur and being a pro, and just having, flipping that switch in our mind. And, we'll get into this a lot, I'm sure, but a pro is hard on themselves, not down on themselves, but hard on themselves. And an amateur is usually pretty easy on themselves. The professional's world is a lot more rigorous mentally and emotionally, psychologically.
How did being an amateur, before you took the step to becoming pro, you say you've got two stages to your life before and after you turned pro. How did the amateur lifestyle manifest for you before you made that change?
Kind of like what I was just talking about, Chris, my life was pretty chaotic. Not necessarily in a bad sense. I mean, there was a lot of kind of adventure going on, a lot of drama and stuff like that. And I met a lot of people that turned out to be interesting people, and went with a lot of places that turned to be interesting places. But I wasn't getting anything done, and I was feeling worse and worse and worse about it. And in general, I was sort of, in one form or another, running away from my real work, my real calling, in, running away physically, going to different places, and running away, in different activities that were what I call in the book shadow activities, not the real activities. They were close to them, but they were not really them. And at the moment that I finally did turn pro, I really just decided, look, this is my calling. This is what I want to do, which is writing. And I have to organize my life in such a way that I can do it. I can't allow chaos to dominate everything, and my and my resistance be defeating me every morning. Procrastination and all that kind of stuff.
So you mentioned there one of the key points that kind of self-identify as an amateur, which is these shadow activities or even shadow careers. How can someone work out if they're going through with a shadow activity or a shadow career?
Well, let me see if I can define it first, Chris, and then it's all obviously nobody can make that judgment except the person themselves, and it's very, very hard a lot of times. But like, I worked in the movie business in LA as a screenwriter for, about 10 years or so, 10 or 12 years. And one of the phenomena that you see there a lot, is there's such a thing as entertainment lawyers. There are entire law firms that are about negotiating deals. And if you're an actor, if you're a director, if you're a writer, you have an entertainment lawyer. And the entertainment lawyer, sometimes they'll actually find work for you, and so certainly will negotiate all the deals for you. And it's sort of a commonplace there that a lot of entertainment lawyers want to be writers or want to be producers. And I think that, and I've talked to people, and they admit it, they laugh and they admit it, that they sort of chose being a lawyer because it was kind of adjacent to the creative field. They didn't chose to be like oil and gas lawyers or corporate lawyers. They chose to be entertainment lawyers. And I think this applies sometimes to agents as well. They're sort of in a field that's adjacent to a creative field, but is not really that field. And I can understand, it makes a lot of sense. You figure, well, if I go to law school, I'm going to have a degree. I'm going to have something I can fall back on. I'm going to have an actual job that pays me. Whereas if I just plunge in being an actor or writer or director, God knows what'll happen. Then another kind of manifestation of this is, Chris, is this is more, I don't want to be sexist here, but it's more women that kind of fall into this. And that is to sort of, but men too. So women, don't get mad at me. People will be somebody else's assistant. They'll kind of sign up to work for a musician or a director or a producer or something like that. And what they really want to do is they really want to produce themselves. So they really want to be a musician themselves. And so they have this kind of shadow career. And I know that you're doing a thing of 6 months sober and stuff like that. And I think that, a lot of times, addictions are shadow careers. I could get into this in great detail, but I think that a lot of times people will, if they get into alcohol, they get into drugs, they get into heroin, they get into, all the things you can get into, their life as an alcoholic or their life as a drug addict becomes their shadow work of art. And rather than write the book that they were going to write or produce the movie or whatever it is that they were going to do, they create this, their own sort of personality, their own drama, their life becomes like a movie. It's got everything, right? And sometimes it even has violence and God knows what else. So I'm probably wandering on too long, but there's
Not at
also
all. Keep going.
there's another phenomenon in America, in the States, particularly in the South, particularly in a place like New Orleans, and maybe in the UK you guys have this too, where people will become quote unquote characters. You know, the crazy old lady that has 33 cats, or, you know, the guy with the hat that wanders around the French Quarter, or whatever. And what they're sort of doing there, and not that there's anything wrong with being a colorful character, but they're, to me, rather than writing their novel or starting their business, they create this image, this thing of themselves, this personality of themselves, that becomes their own sort of work of art. But and in some cases, I guess that's cool, but not if it's eating you up inside, and you really know on some level I should be doing more with my life than that, you know.
I spent a little bit of time last year in New Orleans, and I know precisely the characters that you mean. There's a lady that I saw at one of the parades with, she looked like Mary Poppins, purple hat, green feather boa, like two walking sticks, dancing crazy to the jazz music outside. So I know exactly that. I had Aubrey Marcus, who I know that you're a friend of. I had Aubrey on the show last year, and he said something that really stuck with me, and I think it ties in with what you're talking about here. And he talks about how people protect themselves by building up caricatures of themselves, by wrapping themselves in ego. He says the reason for that is without vulnerability, you don't ever actually have to put anything on the line. Because if the ego or the character that you're playing fails, well, that's not me. I didn't fail. The character I'm playing fails. But the converse of this, which he identified and I absolutely love, was that he said the ego is incapable of receiving love. It can only receive praise. And I think that distinction is really important. The fact that when you play this metacognizant character, you're not you fully open and actualized. You're some analog of that. You're all of the you're all of the veneers of it, but none of the core of it. The praise, the failures that you get don't hurt. But the praise that you get doesn't feel like love because you know that it's not you. And I can attest to this as someone who played kind of a big name on campus party boy for a long time. I realized that veneer a lot of the time was because I was insecure or ashamed about the fact that I had particular interests and curiosities that I didn't think other people would think were cool. So I didn't, I thought I had to talk about partying and girls and booze and blah, 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 because I couldn't talk about the Fermi paradox or what consciousness is or why it is that we have sexual selection. Do you know what I mean? Like there were all of these things, and maybe a lot of the listeners who are tuned into this as well. I think everyone has elements of amateurs in them, right? Everyone's an amateur in probably some area of their life.
Yes. Yes.
You touched on something that I really love. What do amateurs and addicts have in common?
I think that they're both artists, you know, that they both have, and that's why so many musicians are addicts and so many artists are addicts. It's not an accident. I think that they have, and they feel within them a self that wants to be born and work that wants to be produced, that wants to be brought out into the world. And it terrifies both people, terrifies the artist and terrifies the addict. And I think what you were just saying, what Aubrey said, was that rather than be vulnerable, rather than really express that thing, which is, of course, really hard because then you're really letting yourself up for being, you know, particularly these days, you know, massacred. Someone who goes into an addiction, that's really sort of what you were just talking about. It's a second self that's not really the self. So that, you know, whatever happens there, any bad consequences that come from that are not as bad. It's a protective thing, are not as bad as really trying to be the artist or to speak of or to follow the things that you really want to, that you really are interested in, you really do want to pursue, and you're afraid you won't be cool. You're afraid that people will think, you know, what kind of a, you know, kind of a guy is this guy interested in this stuff? He should be interested in rugby and that kind of stuff. So, and of course, that's part of growing up too. You know, when you're young, peer pressure is tremendous, and it, you know, very few people have the guts to really be themselves. It only takes, I think, a lot of pain living that artificial self before the moment comes where you finally say, I just can't do this shit anymore. You know, I've got to be me, whatever, you know.
I really loved, there was an example you used, I think you used Charlie Sheen as one of the examples, and you said that the addict's life is really boring. From the outside, it looks super colorful, but in reality, it's the same boring excuses, the same boring turning up late to work, the same boring story about how many drugs or whatever it was that you had last night. There's no trajectory, right? It's Groundhog Day over and over. And it is
Groundhog Day, yeah.
I'd never heard that said about addicts before, because you see, and it almost gets romanticized in movies and popular culture as well. You know, the addict lifestyle, Rock and Roller, if you've seen that wonderful British film, it has this almost super romanticized view of how the addict spends their time. He's a dying artist, but he's so blah, 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 blah. And you're like, yeah, that is true, but it isn't in place of art. It's instead of art. It's not as if you can substitute the art for the addiction and it's still as beautiful. It's everything that takes up the space of the addiction with none of the beauty.
Yes. And it's funny that when you turn pro, and you start really doing your work, then your life from the outside really does look boring. You know, it's all of a sudden, you know, you're getting up early, you're going to the gym, you're going to your studio or whatever it is. And it's somebody looking for one of your old buddies that used to know you in your addicted days. You know, they said, what happened to you, man? I mean, you used to be fun.
So
you used to,
fun.
I could hang out with you. Now look at you, and all you're doing is practicing ballet steps in your studio or whatever it is. But so it is interesting how what we do think is exciting is really boring as hell. And what looks to be boring on the outside, of course, it's not boring. You know, like people used to say to me, I think I even wrote this in Turning Pro, that I used to work in this office here where I am right now, that my desk used to face the other way, face into that wall. And people would say to me, well, you know, don't you want to have a view outside? How can you look like that? But the answer is I'm living up here, you know, the world that I'm inhabiting or the world that the artist is inhabiting in their studio may look pretty dumb from the outside, but inside a lot of stuff is going on. It's, you know, Game of Thrones is going on inside there. So if you're really doing your work, then you are getting traction. You're not just spinning your wheels constantly.
You talk a lot about tribes and about how the social imperative, the social influence of other people can cause us to compromise and dilute down our professionality, I suppose, and our ability to overcome resistance. And it makes total sense with this, right? Like, why wouldn't you want to do the thing that everyone else thinks is cool, that just looks like so much fun? Oh, he's leading this life. And that's been turned up to 11 with Instagram and Facebook and TikTok and YouTube now.
Yeah.
You know, people live these meta lives where they exist only to create the content. They go on holiday purely to film the content, to make, to put. Do you know what I mean? This is we're going back to this sort of meta life that people have. And that happens in, again, small parts for everyone. But I really think the bravery to be able to be called boring is or weird or different is a powerful mechanism, because as my good friend George McGill says, ordinary people get ordinary results, extraordinary people get extraordinary results. The closer that you get to normal, the closer you regress to the mean of the results everyone else gets. Like, that's precisely the way it works.
I've never heard that before. I like that. Yeah.
It's wonderful. So think about anyone, Kobe Bryant, Michael Jordan. These guys don't have normal work ethics, even in an environment of super normal humans. They're still standouts. Tiger Woods, the relationship he had with his dad was so crazy when he was growing up. But look at what the result was on the back end of that. You know, you have to have extraordinary effort gets extraordinary results. And I think casting off the tribe is an important part of that.
Yeah, another way of looking at that, and I just actually heard this the other day from a friend of mine, Scott Mann, who is a retired lieutenant colonel in the Green Berets. And he was talking about, it's sort of like the Maslow pyramid. You know, where you at the bottom of the pyramid is sort of the tribal which of course we were, where peer pressure is everything, you know, to conform and to be one of the gang. And of course we evolved as, you know, in a tribal environment, you know, for hundreds of thousands of years is like the primitive hunting band. But then you're at kind of in the lower end of the thing. But when you get to this top part of the pyramid, then you're getting kind of that kind of Maslow area of self-actualization or of individuation, you know, where you kind of have cut free from the demands of the tribe and the expectations of the tribe. And you're really becoming whoever it is that you were born to be, whatever your individual essence is. And it's, of course, it, like with Michael Jordan or Kobe Bryant, it's lonely up there, you know? And that's part of the price.
How do people swallow that price then? How do people learn to pay it? Is it getting used to being cast off by the tribe a little bit more each day? How do they do it?
I'm not sure that I can really speak to being in that. I'm trying to be, but I don't know. But I do think that I'll just speak from my own experience. First of all, it's not a sacrifice at all. I feel much happier being in that place up there because I feel like I'm really in my own skin and doing, you know, serving my own muse, whatever that is. But the other thing is that I think as you do evolve into that place, you sort of leave people behind in a way. I know that sounds kind of egomaniacal or, you know, but I'm thinking of David O. Russell movies like The Fighter and Joy, if you remember that one, and also Silver Linings Playbook. He talks about this a lot where he'll have a character like the Mickey, I forgot his name, that played by Mark Wahlberg in The Fighter, who is in this family where everybody, you know, he wants to be a fighter. That's his thing. His brother was a fighter, et cetera, et cetera. In the movie Joy, starring Jennifer Lawrence, she plays this gal that started the mop, the Miracle Mop, on this home shopping network. And both of them were embedded in families where the family was sabotaging them. You know, the family, like the fighter, his mom was his booking agent, and she would, the start of the movie, she books him into this fight where the guy outweighs him by 15 pounds and he just massacres him, you know? And it's like, what are you putting me in, you know? And so, in other words, when you sort of, if you leave people like that behind or you just disengage from them, it's not a bad thing, you know? You feel like I got rid of something that was really holding me back. So it's kind of painful. I'm a guy that feels guilty and is very loyal, you know, like to a fault. But sometimes you do have to follow your own star wherever it goes. And not everybody wants to go on that same path with you.
There's this wonderful quote by James Clear. Changing your habits often requires you to change your tribe. Each tribe has a set of shared expectations. Behaviors that conform to the shared expectations are attractive. Behaviors that conflict with the shared expectations are unattractive. It's hard to go against the group. Often, changing your habits requires you to change your tribe. I love that.
I think it's absolutely true. And one of the things there is your level of aspiration. I mean, a lot of times, it isn't that you've changed your outlook or anything like that. It's just you want to be better. You know, you won't accept the level of achievement or commitment or whatever that people around you are very comfortable in, you know? And like Michael Jordan is a classic example of that, you know, where he had to be really rough on his teammates.
He was a
you know?
Tyrant,
that
was man. He was an absolute
the
tyrant.
Only way he knew how to do it. Yeah. And you could see, I mean, I guess we're both talking about watching The Last Dance. Have you seen, that's it?
Wonderful.
You know, where he would, actually you could see on camera when he was being interviewed where he got, he would get upset, you know, like that one thing where he goes break and he gets up from the chair and ends the interview because I guess he felt a little bad about how hard he was on people, but he wanted to be at, his level of aspiration was different than the tribe and he had to bring them with him.
When you look at it,
or we wanted to, anyway.
When you look at it in the cold light of day, with perspective, the choice really is between being less than you can be to appease other people, or being all that you can be and perhaps upsetting someone. And like for me, it takes a lot of bravery to do that, you know. And you're right as well about the age thing. As a younger person, guy or girl, you just, that confidence to go against the group, you know, everything's new and novel and the world's scary and big. Over time, it's everyone's dad or everyone's uncle, right? You know, the uncle that just doesn't give a shit. Like, he'll farts at dinner and decides to go play golf four times a week. He does his thing. And I think that, like, that level of uncleness is something that we can all aspire to have.
Yes, I'm all for that, yeah.
Final thing, before we move on to what a pro is and the difference between that and an amateur, how can someone self-diagnose if they're an amateur who's chomping at the bit to turn pro? How can someone identify the things? We've got the shadow activity, we've potentially got the addiction. Is there anything else?
Well, I would think anybody that's listening to us talk right now and is in that state, it's probably very obvious to them, to themselves. You know, I know if I were listening to this, my former self, I would say, holy shit, that's me.
Talking, you
know,
about I'm doing, me.
That's exactly what I'm doing, you know. And I think we all do know that, you know. Yeah. It's very clear to us. We're sort of running away from it, you know, all day long, trying to keep that perception from breaking through. So yeah, I think it's more obvious
plain
than
obvious. Good.
You know,
in that case, we have done
the person themselves. You know,
we have done our job in the first half. So, okay, how do we define a professional? How are they different from an amateur?
Well, one of the things that I do say is just sort of like what you were reading there. A professional has professional habits, and an amateur has amateur habits. And so, if we look at the way we live our day, you know. Do we get up at a certain time in the morning, you know, and do we always get up at that time or something like that? Do we have an aspiration? You know, are we aiming at something? Are we ruthless with ourselves? You know, will we not allow ourselves to slack off, or, you know, or only once in a while have a cheat meal or something like that? Or are we just so easy on ourselves, you know, that we're just kind of bouncing around from this to that to the other thing? I think a professional is usually defined, I think, by their aspiration, what it is they're trying to do. You know, if you ask a writer that's a real pro writer, what are you trying to do? They could probably tell you. The book they're working on, they know exactly what it is they want to do. They probably know the next one after that and the one after that. And if they don't, they know that they want, at least they know the path that they want to be on, you know. Whereas I'm thinking about my own amateur days. If you ask me what I want to do, I wouldn't have a clue, you know. I would bounce from one thing to another. Another thing is, I think, I remember, you know, I used to live in my Chevy van. You know, I used to, you know, I didn't think of it as homeless at the time, but I used to live in that kind of situation. And I remember when I would wake up in the morning, you know, in my mattress in the back of my van, wherever the hell I was, I would sort of have to have like a 5-minute session with myself just to tell myself who I was and what I was trying to do with the day. And I had no clue, you know, unless I was in some scene, you know, where there were people and I knew I had to, you know, meet so-and-so or whatever. But in other words, that was a total amateur situation where I had no real, no goal, no aspiration, nothing that was internal, that was driving me from my heart. I was not in touch with my muse, or whatever you want to say, whatever that inspiration is. I don't know. I'm probably babbling a little
bit
here,
Chris.
Not at
all, Stephen. I absolutely love this, and it's so insightful. Something that I've just realized there, going back to the addict thing, I wonder whether having multiple projects or having a lot of different pathways on the go is a form of addiction. So myself and a number of friends I know, we rationalize doing lots of things as hedging. And we say that by having that, I'm spreading risk. I've got multiple streams of whatever it might be. But that's just a form of resistance as well. That's just a form of fear from going all in on the one thing that you know you should do.
I would absolutely define it as a form of resistance. And I get a lot of letters from people like that, where people will say, I've got so many ideas, I just don't know which one to follow, you know? And it's resistance throwing these shiny objects at us, you know, like, what do they call it, chaff? Like when a missile is trying to track an airplane, the airplane will release these aluminum foil shiny objects, and the missile doesn't know what to do, and it gets lost, right? And I think we will create those shiny objects ourselves to distract ourselves, you know? And I think a lot of times when you read the biographies, or you listen to somebody like a Bob Dylan or somebody like that talking about their life, there was no plan B. You know, that they were all in for whatever it was. So, I think when I find myself having like a bunch of projects, I will really try to sit down and whittle those away and just kind of be ruthless in throwing it's not so easy to do. It's hard to. In fact, I'm in a place like that right now where I've got two or three things and I'm not sure which one to go. It's very hard. But I do think that the idea of hedging your bets is not such a great idea.
I think you're correct. And, you know, to continue to sing Michael Jordan's song, Michael played golf as a way to calm down, but he wasn't trying to be a pro golfer whilst he was trying to be a pro basketballer.
No, that's true. Exactly. Yeah.
All in on basketball. Hilariously, I didn't know that he'd gone and played baseball, which is like just such a fun. But even when he played baseball, he was all in on baseball, you know? He wasn't, I'll keep one foot in the door with this thing. Like he was all in. And I definitely think that that's one of the more pernicious ways that resistance can manifest, because it looks like productivity. It looks like achievement, both internally and externally. And what were we just saying about the way that the tribe and this kind of socialized reward is important? Oh, Stephen, you've got so many things on the go. Like you've got three books to write in and the podcast and the YouTube and the blah, blah, blah. And you think, again, what is it? It's boring. Like it looks from the outside in really exciting and varied, but from the inside out, you're not getting the work done. You're just constantly spinning these plates, desperately trying to stop any of them from falling down.
Yeah. Now I might disagree with you, Chris, on the Michael Jordan playing baseball thing.
Interesting.
And of course we won't know if until we have him here and he would tell us.
I'll get him eventually.
But if you remember, now I've watched this thing like five different times, so I was very familiar with The Last Dance. If you remember, his dad died, was murdered right before that. And I think maybe for him, baseball was just sort of a way of taking some time out. Because his dad always wanted him to play baseball, and of allowing that grief to process itself. Because when the time was right, he went back to basketball, you know?
So it was baseball, of course, resistance, do you think, perhaps?
No, I think in some way, maybe it was. Sometimes, you know, like we're talking here now, Chris, about sort of relentlessly powering forward towards a goal, you know? But sometimes you need to take a break from that. You know, we are human. And in a way, I think somehow maybe, you know, I'm psychoanalyzing Michael Jordan, which is a crazy thing. If we only had him here, maybe he just needed with baseball just to be a regular guy for a little while, you know, just to be one of the guys on the team and then go back to being the greatest that ever lived, you know. But I don't know. I'm just guessing.
I think that's a really good insight. And that's something I would be very impressed if you have the answer for this. How do you determine when you've been ruthless enough with yourself? Basically, there's always a challenge between being sufficiently compassionate when you've hit your limit and pushing yourself hard enough to find where it is.
Yeah, I'm going to disappoint you, Chris, because I'm not going to have an answer here. I really, all I can say is it's really hard to know, you know. I know for me, there certainly have been times where I really did back off and just let things go. And a lot of times that was good. But I'm not sure why. I don't know. I wouldn't know how to define it.
It's intuitive, isn't it? It's a question I've asked. You must be like the 10th guest that I've asked that question to. And it is, everyone has the same answer, which is essentially that it's just an intuition. It's a notion. You feel it, you sense it. And you know, when you've gone too far, there's been some times where I've pushed myself so hard with work that I've not been able to get out of bed for a couple of days. You know, you just snap, you have like a miniature breakdown. And I'm just tired and lethargic and I can't think and my thoughts are muddy. And then I snap out of it and I'm like, wow, I guess I did a little bit too. And it's always after an intense period of work. You know, you do 2 weeks, 3 weeks of like just nonstop, bang, 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 bang. And then that happens and you think, okay, that's my limit. And again, what we're talking about over time, we get older, we understand our tolerances a little bit more. We're able to see and feel and use intuition a little bit more, more adaptly. So yeah,
there's another thought, the whole sort of concept of an off season, you know, that, you know, in certain sports, in practically all sports, before people became a year-round fitness kind of thing, there would be an off season, right? And maybe that's makes sense. I mean, if you think about the primitive hunting band, that's where we're living, that's our guts, right? That's our DNA. I'm sure they sort of went out, they hunted, they chased the mastodons, you know, in an insane thing. Then they brought the food back, the bacon back to the cave. And I'm sure they took a couple of weeks off, you know,
feast and maybe fast.
That is kind of a rhythm that we might, you know, emulate a little bit ourselves, because we can drive ourselves crazy trying to get to the top of that pyramid, you know, and self-actualize and all that. You know, it's a good question. I wish I had, you know, a meter that I, you know, could, you know, a switch would go off and say time to take a break.
Like a thermometer. Yeah, I get it. Exactly. Yeah. It's a David Allen-ism where he says your ability to deploy power is directly proportional to your ability to relax.
Oh, really? That's good too, huh?
Wonderful. Yeah, he's... And that, again, like, is that a form of addiction, an addiction to constantly doing the same thing, the inability to let go? And what we're seeing here is that the tighter and tighter circles of nuance and complexity that we're talking about as you pivot from being an amateur to being a professional, when you commit to something, the problems don't necessarily go away. They just get more nuanced and more subtle.
Uh-huh. But, you know, the other thing is, I think being a professional doesn't mean that you have to be grinding every minute of the day, you know? Like if you and I were, if the Olympic Games were 3 years away and we were, whatever, an athlete that was going to compete in such a thing, and we had a brilliant coach like a Phil Jackson or something like that, I'm sure that he would break those 3 years up to for us into periods of intense effort and then a break, you know, and the whole thing aiming to peak at that time, you know, three years from now. So I think being a professional does not necessarily mean you're grinding every minute of the day.
I really like, we keep on coming back to it because it's an easy analogy to use when we talk about athletics and about sports stars.
Yeah.
And I think there's so much that anyone who isn't playing sport can take from people who do. So when you think about just how refined a sports star's life is to maximize their performance, they're eating right, they're sleeping right, they're working on their mental game, they're doing their accessory movements, they're doing their conditioning, they're doing drills, technique, training, they're working with a mindset coach, they're working with, you know, every base is covered. I have a friend, Alex O'Connor, who was on the show recently, and he, I would be surprised if he doesn't become one of the best known vegan philosophers on the planet, Peter Singer sort of style guy. But I know, and I've told him before, I'm like, man, if you want to be the person you want to be, the new Hitch, you want to be the new Christopher Hitchens, if that's who you want to be, you need to be refined in every area of your life, because he's made the commitment to being vegan, but he only eats three meals. I'm like, dude, you need to have 20 meals. You need to be able to, someone asks you about it, you've got the most balanced diet, you've got the best sleep. Do you know what I mean? Like when someone wants to go all in on something, what is this? What's all this stuff over here? Why are you not committed to this? If it's in service of something that you genuinely love, that you genuinely believe is your calling in life, all of these 1% are in service of that.
Yeah, that's true. Now, I'm going to take the opposite side of that, Chris. I know you are. Do you know who Bobby Jones, the golfer, is? Does that ring a bell at all?
No.
Bobby Jones was an American golfer from Atlanta who won the Grand Slam in 1929. I think it was U.S. Amateur, British Amateur, U.S. Open, British Open, as an amateur. He was he founded the Masters. You know, he, anyway, one of the all-time great players ever. And he was an amateur all the way through. And that was back in the days when amateur meant something different. But he was a lawyer. And he worked full-time as a lawyer. And the way his year would go is when winter came around, he was from Atlanta, you know, he would just go to work as a lawyer. Wouldn't touch a club all winter long. And then when it started to get warm in the spring, he would sort of, the phrase he used was play himself back into shape. And he would just kind of get, and by the time, but somehow he was able to do it where he just beat everybody. Like the greatest golfers of their day who at that time was Walter Hagen, Gene Sarazen. These names I'm sure don't mean anything to you, but during his period, Bobby Jones' period, these other guys never won a major tournament that Bobby Jones was in. So the point I'm trying to make here is that there are different ways to peak. Now, the other thing about Bobby Jones, as they said about him, was that in a four-day tournament, he would lose between 12 and 18 pounds just from burning it off. And it was you played in neckties in those days, and it was routine. They would sweat that he had to like cut the necktie off with a knife at the end. So in other words, at the level that he was performing was at the Kobe Bryant level, but he did not have, you know, the coaches and then all that sort of thing. So I'm not lobbying for one way or the other, but there are definitely different ways to do it.
Even in that situation, what we're seeing is someone who is incredibly present when they're doing it, right? You know, if you're losing 18
Absolutely,
pounds over
yeah.
4 days, it's because you,
yeah.
every fiber, every cell in your body is focused on the task.
Yes, that he was able to really bring it, you know, when it counted. In fact, this is off the subject a little bit here, but in the year that he won the Grand Slam, his main challenge was not to screw it up. It's like from the start of the year, he sort of knew, I can win all four of these things, you know. All I have to do is show up and be my, and bring my game, you know. And he talked about, I'm going to wander off a little bit here, but he heard of one other player, might have been a baseball player who was shaving back in the days when you had razor blades that went into a thing. And he dropped the blade, and his reflexes were so sharp, he grabbed it and he cut his hand and he couldn't play, you know, whatever it was, baseball is. And so part of Bobby Jones' day was, don't do that. You know, don't do anything that's going to happen. And anyway, I don't know. That's apropos of nothing, but I love this. I love to read about Bobby Jones and talk about him.
A lot of the stuff that we do, we self-sabotage, right? Both consciously and unconsciously. But avoiding
yes.
doing stupid things, I literally
yes.
did a tweet. It's so dumb. 3 days before I snapped my Achilles, I did a tweet that said, avoid stupidity, don't chase success. And then obviously a couple of days later, I managed to rupture my Achilles.
How did you do that, Chris? What were the circumstances?
Playing cricket.
If you don't mind my asking.
Playing cricket, which is the most British way that you can rupture an Achilles. Batting in cricket and just setting off. So exactly the same way that Kobe Bryant did. In fact, if anyone that's listening is interested, there's a 3D rendering on YouTube of precisely how Kobe Bryant's physiology worked during the match as his Achilles snapped. And if you have your heel off the ground a little bit and then you push back, what you're doing is you're contracting the muscle whilst the eccentric portion of the movement is happening. And that's one of the real sort of perfect storms for it, that you've got this built-up pressure and then eventually your heel hits the floor and all of that elasticity gets snapped and it pulls. Because you can hang a car off your Achilles tendon, But
really,
yeah. So you can think about how much force is going through it, but it's more to do with that snapping, that jerking motion that comes from the plyometric. I mean, that was an ugly day. But even with that, like, I might sort of just tell yourself and the viewers what my experience upon reading Turning Pro was, and this has been a defining characteristic of this year for me, that a lot of people, and myself as well, I'm still recording in my bedroom. It's still me and one guy. We're an independent show. It's not like we have this big team or some production company behind us, which means that it's much easier to be an amateur. It's much easier for me to just, it's a side thing, it's a hobby, it's a this, that, and the other. And partway through the year, upon reading The War of Art, I thought, hang on, you love doing this. This is something that you're compelled to do. It's something that you're called to do. Why are you not going all in? Why are you allowing these other areas to distract you? Why are you not turning up 10 minutes early to every interview that you do? Why are you not preparing as much as you can for every guest that you do? All of these things, all of these one foot out of the door situations were me doing the Aubrey Marcus. Well, if the episode's a little bit crap, I didn't prepare all that much. Therefore, it's not a comment on my capacity. I could have done better. I just chose not to. You inoculate yourself from public failure by assuring your failure privately. That's
very well said.
Yeah. It's something I've thought about a lot this year. Really, really have. And I hope that we can start to give everyone that's listening the impetus, the ability to get over that inertia, to move out of amateur and into professional. So we've spoken about going all in. We've talked about the fact that you need to be ruthless with yourself. What are some of the other heuristics that people can use to ensure that they make the transition from amateur to professional as well as they can?
I never have like checklists or anything like that, because it's so unique to each individual. Like in Turning Pro, there was a passage about Roseanne Cash, the singer, and the dream that she had. Can I tell that story here for your?
Yes, please.
This to me was like the kind of the ultimate Turning Pro moment. Roseanne Cash is Johnny Cash's daughter, and she had a career at the start of her career that was quite successful, kind of as a, you know, she had a bunch of hits and as a singer, but she always wanted to be a songwriter and a singer. She wanted to do concept albums that really came from her heart rather than, picking songs that other people had written. So she had a dream, and it's really important that this is a dream, because it shows it's coming from a part of her, right? And in the dream, one of the people that she idolized was Linda Ronstadt, the singer. So in the dream, she was at a party, and she was sitting at a bench, and Linda Ronstadt was on one side, she was on the other. In between them was an older man that she somehow knew. His name was Art, capital A-R-T. And Art was in intense conversation with Linda Ronstadt in the dream. And Roseanne was kind of trying to get into the conversation, you know. And suddenly this guy turned to her, Art, and looked her up and down with utter contempt and said, "We don't have anything to do with dilettantes." And Roseanne, as she describes this in her book, Composed, she said, "I woke up from this dream shaken to the core," because she felt like she had really been called out. This was really the truth. And she says, "From that moment on, I changed my life. I changed everything about my life. I changed the way I wrote. I attacked music. I started studying painting. I started getting in shape physically. I started, working out. I started studying voice and this and this." And she started attacking certain habits that she had. Like one of the things she said was she had a habit of daydreaming, of just kind of getting off into a fog. And she said she would like teach herself to snap back out of that. And she also had a habit of like not working as hard as she could on some settling for something like that. And also of writing a song or preparing a song that was good enough, you know, but it didn't have the element of madness to it that she was looking for. So that's kind of a case where she herself decided, she just knew, I've got to change. I can't keep going the way I'm going. So she sort of invented what the changes were that she was going to make. She was going to study this and study that and get up earlier and eat better and all that sort of thing. So in other words, I think that once we kind of make that commitment, we'll know. We'll know what we're supposed to do. We'll know where we've been sloughing off, eating sugar, whatever it is, like, you know, that kind of thing.
That's a beautiful story. I really, really love that. And then you yourself, was it the first time that you turned pro, you locked yourself in a hut in the woods for like $15 a week or something like that? And you
Wow, that is great. That's great, Chris, the way people see it. You know what? But I really, thinking back over it, because I have been thinking back, I probably have had maybe 15 turning pro moments. You know, there wasn't just one, you know. But what I did then was I saved enough money and moved to a small, affordable house, a little house.
Cabin in the woods, Stephen. It was a cabin in the woods. They call it small.
It was in the woods, sort of. But yeah, so I really just sort of locked myself in this underwater thing where I couldn't leave, because I knew that my resistance was so strong that I would quit otherwise. So anyway, but we do have a bunch of these turning pro moments, not just one.
Do you think that something symbolic like that is a potential tool that people can use?
Yes, definitely.
To commit to manifest,
you know,
it into the real
symbolically.
World.
Symbolically. Yeah. I mean, look at Roseanne Cash's dream. You know, there's a guy called Art. I mean, you know, really, that's the way the mind works. So, yeah. I mean, I wonder if your Achilles injury wasn't a way of making you focus on, you know, the podcasting and stuff like that.
Very well might be.
But so don't let me psychoanalyze you.
Hey, I would love it. One thing, an example that the listeners will be familiar with from last year for me was I've had a back injury as well, a couple of bulging discs, and I read a book by the world's expert on spinal pain, a guy called Dr. Stuart McGill. I had him on the show. I really enjoyed him. And I thought, I keep on going to different physios. Nothing really seems to be working. I'm going to make a commitment. I'm going to make a pilgrimage to go and see him in Canada. So I'm in America. I've done this road trip that I mentioned where I went through New Orleans and Nashville and a bunch of other places. And at the end of that, as opposed to, I'd already booked my flight home, but Stu very, very kindly said, if you come out fishing with me and you catch a fish, I'll do your consultation for you. And I decided to sack the flight off that was going home. So that was, you know, maybe £700. I flew from Norfolk to Toronto, then rented a car, then drove for 2 hours north on my own to go and see this like crazy white mustached man, and met him and his wonderful wife and their dog, and stayed with them and spent the evening, and he did this like brilliant assessment. And that to me was a symbolic, it was like a pilgrimage, right? It was like a journey that I made. And as soon as I came back, my compliance on the things that he told me to do was monomaniacal. I did, if he said it, I did it. And part of that was the pilgrimage, this symbolic gesture that I'd made to him and myself.
Yeah, that's a great thing. You know, there's we're probably running out of time. I'll see if I can cram this in here.
Oh, we've got loads of time. Keep going.
There's a wonderful book about interpretation of dreams called Inner Work by Robert Johnson, which I highly recommend to anybody. He's a Jungian. And one of the things he said is when you have a dream that's a real powerful dream, do something physical in your life to memorialize that. And so your trip to Canada, that was that. And I think there's a lot to be said for that. Like here, I don't know if you can see this. You know, I had that dream that I talk about in the War of Art called Largo. Can you see that?
Yeah, Largo.
Where I was a character called Largo in a dream. And anyway, so I
had
a little
badge called Largo
ID tag.
That's amazing.
There. But that was, you know, memorial. So I think that was what you did when you went to Canada. It was a great thing that you did. I take my hat and look at, you know, the bulging disc turned out to be one of the best things that happened to you.
I couldn't agree more. I wonder how many people, again, that are listening can try and think about what small symbolic gestures they can make to themselves and to the world around them. You know, like, how do you self-define now? So previously I would have I remember this was only at the start of this year. I went to a party and we were surrounded by very, very rich British aristocracy and the guy that organized London 2012. And people were asking, oh, so what do you do? What do you do? What do you do? And I remember feeling almost this pride in saying, oh, well, that's a very long answer. I do this and I do this and I do this and I do this. And now I just say I'm a podcaster because that is how I've chosen to self-define. And I wonder whether there's people listening who are moonlighting as a dance teacher or as a football coach or as an artist or a comedian or whatever it is, but they still self-define as job title who has an interest in doing this. You know, like yes, the subtext, exactly. The subtitle. So, you know, even that as a symbolic gesture, how do you self-define?
Yeah. Yeah. I can tell you for me, it took me probably 30 years before I could say with a straight face that I'm a writer, you know? And I think a lot of times we can sort of say, well, I'll just claim that identity now prematurely. And I'm not so sure that works. I think sometimes it doesn't, but it certainly is great. You know, I mean, you are a podcaster, Chris. So you said it, you did it. That's great.
You got to earn it, right? You got to earn it through the self-doubt and the imposter syndrome and the complete lack of confidence and everything else that comes with it.
Yeah.
I got
if
two
questions. If it makes anybody feel any better, I'm just starting a new book right now and I am completely terrified and I have no idea if it's the right thing. You know, I just don't. The only thing I'm telling myself is just keep going for a while. You know, just keep get, you know, 80 or 90 pages and then worry about it. You know, but I'm as terrified as anybody.
And that's
even after 50 years.
After such a long half a century of writing words down, and you're starting a new book and terrified.
But I think that's good. You know, I think that's the way it ought to be. You know.
Doesn't it show that you care?
Even Michael Jordan, when he came back after playing baseball, came back to basketball, he was scared, you know? He didn't know, am I going to be able to do this?
I have a friend who's been on the show, a very famous DJ called Christoph, supported Eric Prydz, played some of the biggest festivals in the world. And he, every set, this is a man who I've known DJing, I've watched DJ for 15 years. He's played to 20,000 people, arenas, toured with the biggest DJs on the planet, and before every set, even now, he'll have played 500,000 sets he'll have done. He feels sick. They have a sick bucket ready from before he goes on every single time, and it's because he cares. It's because he gives a shit.
Yeah, I think that's good. I think that's a great sign, even though it might not be fun for him.
He doesn't feel it at the time.
Anybody, yeah, it's exactly. Not fun, but I think that's the way it ought to be. If you get complacent and you think I got this down, that's not good.
You've touched on something there, which was a question I had. Is it possible to fully defeat resistance? And it feels like a bank account that you need to put money into every day to overcome. It feels like that's what
you never defeat it. You know, it's sort of, resistance really gives meaning to life, just like the devil gives meaning to, you know, any pursuit of anything. If it wasn't there, you know, so it's a good thing that it is there, that we do have to slay that dragon every morning.
The same thing with death, right? Like the reason that life has meaning is the fact that it's going to end.
Yeah. We might not be happy about it, but, you know, yeah, true.
That's the way it works. I have a final question for you, which I was listening to you on Lex Friedman's podcast. I highly recommend anyone who's listening to go and check that episode out. And your description was that we're spiritual beings trapped in a physical form. What did you mean by that?
Well, that's not original with me, you know, but I absolutely do feel that we're, that life exists on two levels, you know, that there's the material level that we're on, you know, where the everyday world where we have a body, but then there's a higher level above us. And the artist is trying to reach that level, you know, so is the athlete. So is anybody that's trying to reach that sort of flowed sort of state, you know? And I think that we on this level, we sort of remember that level. We have, you know, we can't put our finger on it, but we know that, you know, and I also think that when we see when we're on the material plane and we see somebody act according to the rules of the higher plane, it moves us tremendously. you know, somebody that runs into a burning building to save a child that they don't even know, that, you know, that kind of thing. So, yeah, I definitely think that we are, we're spiritual. I don't know why we're in bodies. You know, God must have some plan. You know, there must be some concept. We're doing penance, or we're trying to learn something, or I don't know what. But definitely, I always define my, people say, well, what is your job? And I just say, I'm a servant of the muse. And what I mean by that is I'm serving this level. I'm trying to communicate to that level and play according to the rules of that level as much as I can.
They say that true hell is when the person that you are meets the person you could have been. And I suppose that gap between the physical and the astral, or the literal and the spiritual, I suppose that's the gap which we're all trying to close.
Yes, I think so. That's where all the pain, anxiety, all that comes, where addiction comes from, is that gap.
All the fun stuff. And I suppose that's also the gap between amateur and professional. So it all maps on.
Yes, I think so.
Stephen, today's been wonderful. When can we expect you back on to talk about this new book? Is it going to be 2021? Is it going to be 2022?
I'd love to do it. The book comes out in March.
You better get a shuffle on then.
Here it is. It's called A Man at Arms, and it's a novel.
Oh, wow.
So let's put it on the on the schedule somewhere.
We'll put it in the calendar. We'll get you
whenever
back.
You want, sometime in the new year. That'd be great, Chris.
Wonderful. Anything else that people should check out online? Obviously, link to The War of Art and Turning Pro will be in the show notes below. Is there anywhere else you want to send people?
Well, actually, I do have a little talk about an amateur. I do have a kind of a no-frills video series going on right now on Instagram and stuff. It's called The Warrior Archetype. And I'm sure if you kind of search for it, it's like on 2 days a week, like just me on camera filmed by my girlfriend, Diana, and edited by my friends, Jeff and Matt. And it's 2 times a week, and it's going to go for, I don't know, into the new year somehow. I'm just kind of talking about that, the thing that you access when you're playing cricket and when you're doing that other thing, the warrior archetype.
I love it. Stephen, thank you so much for your time. It's been a real pleasure.
Hey, great. It's a pleasure to meet you, and let's do this again, and thanks for having me, Chris. And my best to all of your viewers and listeners.